Might we be about to witness the second Cuban revolution? We will see. Things are happening. Welcome. It is Eric Erickson here. The Eric Erickson Show across the nation from my flagship station, WSB, in Atlanta, Georgia, to all parts of the nation via satellite and that series of tubes known as the Internet. You can call in and be a part of it. 877-97-ERIC, 877-973-7425. Let me bring you guys up to speed on what is happening in Cuba. It's kind of a big deal. There is an uprising happening in Cuba. We don't know how long it will be sustained. You know, when Barack Obama was president and these uprisings started in Iran, the Middle East, in Cuba, he always sided with the dictators. Encouragingly, Joe Biden this morning has come out and sided with the Cubans protesting. Now, notably, it took Biden about 48 hours to come out with a statement. A lot of Republicans in Congress came out pretty aggressively. Members of the Florida congressional delegation, from Marco Rubio to various members of Congress, came out pretty current as soon as this started happening. The New York Times kind of had this weird tweet. I'm not going to throw a lot of shade at the New York Times because of the way their tweet was worded. It was that they were the Cubans were protesting, saying they wanted freedom and other anti-government statements. My buddy Alex Griswold, who writes at the Washington Free Beacon, pointed out that that actually in context wasn't the bad statement that some people take, in large part because freedom is an anti-government slogan in the context of Cuban politics. Joe Biden has released the following statement. We stand with the Cuban people and their clarion call for freedom and relief from the tragic grip of the pandemic and from the decades of repression and economic suffering to which they have been subjected by Cuba's authoritarian regime. The Cuban people are bravely asserting fundamental and universal rights. Those rights, including the right of peaceful protest and the right to freely determine their own future, must be respected. The United States calls on the Cuban regime to hear their people and serve their needs at this vital moment rather than enriching themselves. Now, this is from Jose de Cordoba at the Wall Street Journal. Thousands of Cubans took to the streets in a wave of demonstrations in Havana and at least 14 other cities throughout the communist island, demanding an end to the 62-year dictatorship and protesting the lack of food and COVID-19 vaccines. "We are not afraid. We are not afraid," people shouted. "Freedom, freedom," they chanted. The protests are unprecedented in a country with tight police control and surveillance on dissidents. In a televised address on Sunday, President Miguel Díaz-Canel blamed the protests on the United States, which he said seeks to economically strangle Cuba and bring about a social explosion. "Revolutionaries to the street," he said, asking government supporters to rally support and take back control of the streets. "The order for combat has been given," he said. The Biden administration says it was deeply concerned about the government's response. "We stand by the Cuban people's right for peaceful assembly. We call for calm and condemn any violence," says Julie Chung, the State Department senior official in charge of Latin America. Now, you got to remember, Díaz-Canel took control of Cuba. Fidel Castro passed the torch to Raul Castro before he died. Raul Castro decided to retire in 2018. So now Díaz-Canel is in charge. First time a Castro brother hasn't been in charge in decades. Díaz-Canel is, well, he doesn't have, dare I say, the gravitas of the Cuban Castro brothers. Nobody really cares about him. He's just a partisan hack, essentially, for the Communist Party in Cuba. And now you've got these riots starting, and the guy seems to be woefully unprepared. It's very interesting to see what's going on there. There are internet outages now. There are power outages now. And they don't have a lot of vaccine. COVID is running rampant on the island. Now, there's another story. Kudos to the Wall Street Journal for covering this so thoroughly. This is an opinion piece that kind of sets some context for it. Cubans poured into the streets Sunday to protest the government's handling of the COVID crisis As the virus races around Cuba, independent lawyers, medical professionals, and civil rights groups on the island have begged Havana to allow international humanitarian aid to reach the people directly. The regime refuses. Now the crisis is near cataclysmic proportions. Havana wants the world to believe that Cuban hardship in health care is caused by the U.S. embargo, but food and medicine are exempt from the embargo. Julie Chung, now acting Assistant Secretary of State for Western Hemisphere Affairs, tweeted in April 2020 that the U.S. routinely authorizes the export of humanitarian goods, agricultural products, medicine, and medical equipment to support the Cuban people. She also noted that in 2019, the U.S. exported millions of dollars of medical goods to Cuba. The real problem is that Cuba's broke. While all poor countries in the region have struggled to serve the public during COVID-19, only Cuba has made things worse by trying to use the pandemic as a way to earn hard currency for the ruling elite and boost its legitimacy. Shortages of medications for treatable illnesses in Cuba are routine. The contagious mite infestation of the skin known as scabies can be remedied with antibiotics and topical medication, yet Cuban health officials have been helpless to stop it from spreading. Cuba promotes itself as a world-class healthcare powerhouse, but as the scabies epidemic shows, I'm literally itching in studio now thinking about this. The decrepit hospital and outpatient network can't even tend to the overrun of illnesses, never mind COVID. The president of Cuba has also not invested in the vaccine supply, though given plenty of opportunity. So you got Cuban people in the street, 14 cities, pretty big. The Biden administration now speaking out, unlike the Obama administration, the Biden administration speaking out for the Cuban people. The question is, what's going to happen? So for years and years, the Cubans have been dependent on Moscow. With the fall of the Soviet Union, the Russians still maintained large numbers of ties to the Cuban island, but increasingly it went looking for support from China, the last big communist regime on the planet. And the Chinese and the Venezuelans have been trying to help Cuba, but Venezuela's now broke, and China's on the far side of the world and has to get across the United States to get anything to Cuba. In addition, we still have a military presence on their island. It's going to be fascinating to watch this shape up. It's a new dynamic that shows communist regimes are not fully stable. It's one reason. Let me just put China in perspective for you. China is undoubtedly our global competitor. They're not an ally. They are, if anything, an enemy. They are a competitor. There's a story today that they were able to push away turn back a U.S. military vessel. The Chinese want to expand their sphere of influence globally. They don't want to be a regional superpower. They now want to be a world power. They think that the West is in decay, and to a degree, there are plenty of indications that it is. They think that their time has come, and to a degree, it is. The problem, though, and the intriguing part of this is that one of the big reasons that China is able to sustain itself in the way it is because its regime very shrewdly has been able to convince the Chinese people that everyone else is out to get them. The Chinese have relied on very nationalistic rhetoric in order to keep power in China. They convinced the people the United States is to blame for the problems, very much what the Cubans are doing, what all dictatorships do, that it's other people to blame. They rely on nationalistic fervor against Japan and South Korea and the United States. They convince that the Chinese people that they will be dominant, they will reign supreme, just be patient. But part of that reason is because the undercurrents in China are deeply destabilizing. For all of the talk about Western income inequality, and there is data to show there is significant income inequality around the world, in the West, in the United States. It's far worse in China, a communist regime. And, you know, I got to tell you, I am increasingly convinced that a lot of the income inequality rhetoric in this country, among other things, is driven by people sympathetic to China, either paid or otherwise. I firmly believe that that's the situation. In China, there is massive income inequality. In China, there is massive inequality. The urban and rural divide in China is bigger than anything in this country. The poor people in rural areas are forced to stay there to grow food for the rich people in urban areas. And in China, they have plenty of communications tools, though heavily monitored, where people can air their grievances. And in rural parts of China, it has become a real thing. Likewise, as Hong Kong becomes more integrated into China, it is scary how easily people bend towards totalitarianism, but also it is notable the number of people in Hong Kong who refuse to do so, who are still quietly now agitating for fear for their lives. A lot of people getting arrested. They're going into Chinese prisons where they are collaborating with other dissidents. There is an underground church movement in China. There's a lot of data to suggest there are more actual Bible-believing Christians in China right now than there are Americans, period. Yeah, all Americans combined are right now dominated by the number of actual Bible-believing underground Christians in China. The Chinese government lives in fear of the spread of Christianity because they saw what happened in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union after Pope John Paul II went there. The destabilizing effects of missionary sleeper cells, if you will, of Southern Baptists and others in the Soviet Union and parts of the Eastern Bloc. They are scared to death of the destabilizing effects of Christianity as it spreads through the country. They're trying their best to, much likely they've done with capitalism, trying to weave it into communism. They're trying to weave Christianity into communism and build a kind of communist nationalist Christian identity, which clashes with the underground churches. There's a lot of destabilization there. China has done better, more successfully than other communist regimes, doing essentially whatever they need to do to preserve the Communist Party as the monopoly political party and not necessarily the communist ideals per se, just another different form of totalitarianism now masking behind Marxism. The Cubans have failed at this. They don't have the money. They don't have the resources. They don't have the size and scale to be able to do that. They've been dependent on other people. And their experiment in Cuban communism appears for the first time in decades to be destabilizing. Now, typically what happens is you have a massive military crackdown. And a lot of people get killed in the streets. They essentially send out the communist mob. They send out their version of the wokes to beat up all the people. But there are a lot of people, and something has to be going on in the country for this many people in these many places to feel emboldened. 15 cities in China, in Cuba, calling for an end to the communist regime. That's really significant because typically the protests center in Havana or a couple of other larger cities, but these are spread around the island. And in so being, it's notable, the U.S. response here is going to be very interesting, particularly if the Cuban regime decides to get violent on its people. What is going to happen? We need to keep our eyes on this. It's the big story of the day. Even the New York Times is catching up on this. This is a story that they've just released. This is a quote. Biden's comments on Cuba represented something of a shift in tone from that of former President Barack Obama, who had emphasized sweeping aside decades of animosity between the two countries and cutting loose the shackles of the past. Well, that's good. His statement could have been a little more direct, but at least it's a departure from Obama. Let's see. We've got the The Cuba's dictator went on national television and accused Mia Khalifa of working with the American government to fuel protest. Who is Mia Khalifa? Looks like a musician from what? Seriously? From Brazil? Okay. My goodness. All right. I have no idea. Maybe she's I'm reading her Twitter bio. I've reached my age where I'm too old. In any event, it's Eric Erickson here. The phone number is 877-97-ERIC, 877-973-7425. I don't want to go there. Philip is telling me avoid this topic. Now I've got to Google and see a Lebanese American media personality, webcam model, and former porn star. Oh my good, Philip, how do you know this? How does my team know these things? Oh, my goodness gracious. All right, here's the bio. Mia Khalifa is a Lebanese-American media personality, webcam model, and former pornographic actress. She began acting in pornography in October 2014, becoming the most viewed performer on Pornhub for 2 months. Her career choice was met with controversy in the Middle East, particularly because she performed sexual acts while wearing a hijab. Okay. And now today, the dictator of Cuba is blaming her for sparking protests. Let's see.
The Americans began supporting the embargo.
There we go. Oh, this guy, is he serious? Apparently so. Also, well done, Philip. I appreciate the information. We won't ask how you know that. I'm a terrible boss. My kid, by the way, so on Friday after the show, I went golfing with Philip and my 12-year-old son, and they entered into a putting competition, and my son won with one stroke. And on Sunday, yesterday, Philip comes to the house. Those of you who don't know, Philip handles all the digital stuff for the show. And the kid has a card for Philip. I don't know what the card is. I assume it's a rubbing it in that that the 12-year-old beat Philip in the putting competition. Nope. No. Philip opens the card, and it's a sympathy card, and it says, "I'm sorry your boss sucks. My 12-year-old gave it to my employee." We're going on vacation tomorrow evening. The 12-year-old will be riding on the hood of the car. He doesn't know that yet. Yeah, my kid gives my employee a card that says, "I'm sorry, your boss sucks." All right, we got other stuff to talk about. So Eric Adams, there's a point to be made about Eric Adams. Before we get there, though, Wells Fargo, I find this story very curious. Wells Fargo is telling customers it's shuttering all of their personal lines of credit. One of the big issues there, it seems, is the feds have put some level of cap on what Wells Fargo can finance. So they got to get rid of some of these personal lines of credit. But there's a side angle here. One story points out. So Wells Fargo had too many customers use their personal lines of credit with low interest to pay off their high interest Wells Fargo credit cards. And it's hurt Wells Fargo. So they're shutting down their personal lines of credit. Wells Fargo is in some deep financial waters right now. And I'm starting to believe that the U.S. government has created so much moral hazard in the bailouts of banks over the last few years that at some point we need to let the banks collapse. It'll be short-term painful. But long-term, I don't think we can fix what's really ailing our economy unless we let some of these banks die. Hello there. I have a question. First of all, it is Eric Erickson here, and you can call in the program today. 877-97-ERIC, 877-973-7425. I have the explanation of why everybody apparently knows this Mia Khalifa porn star, and I did not. I was just like casting aspersions on their sanctification, but apparently she went all anti-Israel and got eaten alive on Twitter a few months ago, and I guess I missed it. At least that's what they're telling me. Nonetheless, have you heard who the mayor of New York is? I want to spend a couple of minutes on this. And it actually kind of undermines my point that I'm spending time on it, but just bear with me here. Have you heard of the New York mayoral race? I bet you have. What about the race for mayor of Los Angeles? If you're listening to me and you're not in Georgia, what about the race for the mayor of Atlanta? What about the race for the mayor of Seattle? Those are large cities, Los Angeles, the biggest of them all. And yet there's been very, very, very little coverage of the mayor of Los Angeles and that race and the scandal related there too. There's actually a pretty big scandal out there related to the current mayor's chief of staff who had to step down. But you haven't heard any of this in the national press. Why haven't you? Because the American mainstream media lives in New York. CNN is headquartered there. NBC is headquartered there. ABC is headquartered there. CBS is headquartered there. Fox News is headquartered there. The New York Times is obviously there. Every major media outlet is in New York City. Therefore, we as a people nationwide, 350 million of us, are forced to listen to coverage of the New York mayoral race, even though none of us live there, even though that mayor will impact very few of us, the media covers it. In the same way the media covers the weather in New York when it snows in New York, everything about New York, the entire media is New York-centric, which shows you the biases, even at a place like Fox, that the level of biases that are involved in shaping the news. Now, I say all of that, and now I actually want to spend some time on what Eric Adams had to say on television, because he was invited on CNN with Jake Tapper, and he said a couple of things that are notable. Because Eric Adams used to be a Republican. He was in the police department in New York. He was a Republican. He then got elected as a Democrat to the New York legislature. And then he went back, built up a coalition in New York City, and has now become elected mayor, or he will become elected mayor. Even a lot of Republicans are backing him. The Republican candidate never gets elected in New York, with the exception of Rudy Giuliani back in the day. It's not going to happen. Adams is going to be, and he is also relentlessly anti-crime and pro-police, and a lot of progressives can't stand him as a result. So he was on with Jake Tapper. And one of the things that he talked about was the New York Elections Board, which is so bad. The New York Elections Board was literally still counting presidential ballots in the middle of December of 2020. Now, we all knew Donald Trump wasn't going to win New York or New York City. But the fact that a month and a half after the election, they're still counting ballots is a problem. And now they've done this this tiered voting system. In New York, what do you call it now? All of a sudden my mind is blanked out. In any event, it doesn't matter. It's a terrible, form of voting that all of my nerd friends love. And they completely screwed that up. Ranked choice voting. I knew I'd get it. Then they screwed it up. And now Eric Adams has this to say.
If you win in November, do you think state lawmakers should professionalize or remake the Board of Elections?
Oh, yes, I do. We need to move deeper into the 21st century. We need to utilize technology. Would you believe when they did ranked choice voting, they introduced it in January. They were not ready. The pandemic hit. And then right now, the only person that's in the room when they push the button to determine the ranking is one person. That is not transparency. That is not how we should move towards reform in this area. So I say yes. I'm hoping the state come together and put in place some real reform that would professionalize the operation and then pay the employees better, give them the equipment they need. Let's move this important process forward.
He's really not out to lunch on that, making a lot of sense here. But then he turned to crime with Jake Tapper, and that's where it gets interesting.
Yes, I do. I believe those priorities, they really were misplaced. And it's almost insulting what we have witnessed over the last few years. Many of our presidents, they saw these numbers. They knew that the inner cities, particularly where black, brown, and poor people lived, they knew they were dealing with this real crisis. And it took this president to state that it is time for us to stop ignoring what is happening in the south sides of Chicago's, in the Brownsville's, in the Atlantas of our country. And so it is extremely important that just as we became energetic after we saw mass shootings with assault rifles in the suburban parts of our country, which we should have also focused on the handgun. The numbers of those who are killed by handguns are astronomical. And if we don't start having real federal legislation match with states and cities, we're never going to get this crisis under control.
Aha! He's disagreeing with the Democrats defunding the police effort, but he also thinks the Democrats don't do enough to stop handgun crime. Now, this puts the Democrats in a very difficult position. Because for the longest time, the Democrats' anti-gun agenda was based on AR-15s, not Glock 19s. Too many Americans own handguns. This was an inconvenient truth from Eric Adams. Now, Eric Adams, you should note, doesn't want to actually ban guns. He's actually not anti-gun like most Democrats. He does want more regulation on guns. He does want to crack down on them. He does want to make it more difficult to buy. He doesn't want to ban them. But also, it is notable that he has kind of exposed something on the Democratic Party that a lot of people don't want to talk about. The majority of violence in this country is by handgun. And the Democrats have not proposed any legislation or any major policies to crack down on handguns in this country. They always focus on AR-15s. Assault rifles, they call them, because it's called the Armalite. They call it the AR, which people think stands for Assault Rifle 15. It does not. It's become a very easy branding issue for the Democrats, and they don't have a solution for handguns, and here's why. There are more guns in private ownership in the United States than there are people in the United States. What do you call a one-time gun owner? A first-time purchaser, because they're going to go back and buy more guns. Because everyone who buys a gun tends to buy more guns. It is the exception. People who only have one gun, they are the exception. I've got, let's see, one, two, three, four, five, six, seven, and then my wife has one, two, three, four, five. So I think, well, we had 14 until the boating accident next week. I still want to buy more. In fact, a buddy of mine the other day offered to sell me two Czech rifles, and I'm thinking I may have to buy them because you should always have more. I'm struggling getting ammo. But the bulk of the guns in my house are handguns. I've got a CZ. I've got a Heckler Koch. I've got a variety of Glocks. My wife has a variety of Glocks. She's got a Smith & Wesson. She's got a Ruger. And the majority of our guns are handguns. And none of the Democratic legislation would actually prevent us from buying handguns. They want to stop us from getting our ARs. I got a couple of models from Daniel Defense. I want to get a couple more. I want to get a Benelli shotgun for turkey hunting. I've got aspirations to buy more guns. I've got to have higher income to do so. You people need to sell your ads. I want more guns. Everybody does. But again, to Eric Adams' point, the Democrats, when they talk about gun control in this country, they never talk about handguns. And in New York City and in Chicago and in Atlanta, it's handgun violence. They can't crack down on it, though, because there would be open rebellion even among the Democratic Party base that claims to want gun control. One more clip from Eric Adams on this.
And the Democratic nominee for mayor of New York City, Eric Adams, joins me now. Mr. Adams, thanks so much for joining us. Congratulations on your victory. I want to start with crime, which is, of course, an issue you highlighted during the race. Murders in New York City rose dramatically in 2020 compared to 2019. They're up another 11% so far this year. Gun arrests almost doubled in June over last June. And you have made combating crime a central issue to your campaign. Assuming that you win in November, What should New Yorkers expect to see that will be different, bringing back stop and frisk, reinstating that plainclothes unit going after illegal guns? What will change?
A combination of things. Number one, I believe for the first time, we're going to see a coordinated effort between the president, the governor, the mayor, to go after the flow of guns in our city, which is extremely important. But then right on the ground, how do we deal with the intervention aspects of it? We're going to see the remake of a anti-gun unit that's going to do precision policing, focusing on gangs and guns. We're going to have a coordinated effort to ensure our gun suppression unit receives the resources they deserve. And then we're going to be extremely comfortable with going to our judges and stating we can't have people who participate in gun violence and they're out the next day. That's unacceptable. We need to send a clear message that our streets are going to be safe.
The Democrats are going to have to deal with this guy for a few years. And by the way, a lot of them don't like him because he was a Republican. They don't trust him. He's also deeply outspoken, and he was a police officer. He's very law and order. Now, keep this in mind. New York City has just elected a district attorney who has pledged not to prosecute crime. So follow along with me here. Let's go full circle to the beginning. How many of you have heard of Eric Adams off this program? I bet you a lot. I bet you a lot. Because the media covers Eric Adams. The media covers Eric Adams and not the mayoral race in Atlanta, the mayoral race in Seattle, the mayoral race in Los Angeles, because they all live in New York City. This guy is their mayor. So on national news programs, they treat him as if he is a national news story. New York City just elected a district attorney who has pledged not to prosecute crime. At the same time, they've elected a mayor who has pledged to get tough on crime. The media is going to be forced to cover the spectacle because they always cover the stuff in New York. They're going to cover this. They're going to have to cover this information. They can't avoid it. They can't avoid the discrepancy of white Manhattan voters choosing a DA for Manhattan who refuses to prosecute crime, and the voters of New York overall choosing a mayor who wants to prosecute crime, who wants to go tough on criminals, who wants to have a crackdown. And it's going to be really, really, really hard to not note the prosecutors refusing to prosecute. You know, I got an email from a listener. On Friday, I mentioned a girl in Athens, Georgia, who someone strangled her, put her in a bathtub full of water, hoping to make it look like she had drowned. She did not. She survived. A family member of this girl reached out to me to thank me for covering the story. Someone else reached out. They were her friend. They thanked me for covering the story. It was never in the press. And another girl on in Athens was cut in the face with a box cutter by a homeless man. And so a listener emails me and he says, I'm not doubting you, but I can't find any news stories on either of these things. How do you know they happened? And this is part of the problem that we as a society are dealing with, is that we tend to rely on the media to cover these sorts of stories. And increasingly, there isn't a local media to cover these stories, and the national media does not. The national media doesn't cover them, and most people can presume that these sorts of things never happen because the national media doesn't cover them. But a lot of the stuff, like the crime wave in the country, we can believe it because we know people it's impacting. We hear from people it's impacting. And in New York City, where these reporters live, and you've got a former police officer turned mayor who wants to go after the criminals, and the DA is saying, I'm not going to prosecute people, it's going to be very interesting to watch how it shapes up. I have a prediction for you. I have a prediction. Instead of going after the criminals, the new DA is going to go after the mayor, and the media will cover it as if the new mayor is getting his just comeuppance. And they will leave out the spectacle of a DA who wants to go after a mayor instead of going after a criminal. Well, Texas Democrats in the state legislature, they're meeting to change the election rules in Texas. And Texas Democrats have just walked out of the legislative session depriving a quorum to the special session. Governor Abbott was on with Chris Wallace this weekend talking about this stuff.
Chris, remember this, and that is before that I was governor. I was the Attorney General of Texas, and I prosecuted voter fraud cases across the entire state. And my successor, Kim Paxton, has been prosecuting voter fraud across the state, including the most recent arrest and indictment just taking place this past Friday. However, I have to disagree with the statement that was just made, as well as the public perception, because I'm going to give you the words of a federal district judge appointed by Barack Obama. And the federal district judge said that voter fraud occurs, quote, in abundance as it involves a ballot harvesting. On top of that, Barack Obama and the Biden administration, when they were in office, they came down to the state of Texas to send an FBI team as well as a U.S. attorney to investigate and to prosecute a voter fraud scheme where cocaine was being used to buy absentee ballots. I will tell you this also, Chris, and that is even Democrats in the Texas House of Representatives, they agree that as it concerns mail-in ballots, that is an area where improving the mail-in ballot system is a way to achieve greater election integrity. So what Texas is doing is we're making it easier to vote by adding more hours of early voting than we had in current law, but also making it harder to cheat with regard to mail-in ballots.
Now, listen to Chris Wallace, though. Chris Wallace goes all in on the "you're making it harder for people of color to vote" routine, which is the Democratic talking point that isn't actually true. But listen to this exchange.
Well, Governor, let me ask you, though, about two other things that the GOP bills would do. I want to put them up on the screen. They would ban 24-hour voting, and they would ban drive-through voting. Now, there was no allegation of any fraud in either of those. Harris County, the Houston area, employed both of those, and more than half of the voters who showed up were people of color. So you say you want to make it easier to vote. That's going to make it harder to vote. And the question is, why make it harder for some Texans to vote unless the point is to suppress voting by people of color?
So you mentioned a couple of things that need to be responded to. One, you mentioned how Harris County did this, and it was Harris County alone. And for your viewers, Harris County is where Houston, Texas is located. Let's go back to Article 1, Section 4 of the United States Constitution, where it says in there that it is the states, not counties, that have the authority to regulate elections. And despite that constitutional mandate, this past election, Harris County, a county, tried to create its own election system that had never been used in the state of Texas. It was not used in other parts of the state of Texas. And so what the state of Texas is doing.
Why not let it go on? Governor,
I can give you some
ease. The question is, if 24-hour voting worked, why not continue it?
Because 24-hour voting is a ridiculous waste of time for those who have to run the elections. You forget about the people who are in there for 24 hours, overwhelmed.